Hello, it is Liam Schmidt here from Irish Funds. We're delighted to bring you the next podcast episode from our recent Irish Funds Annual Conference, entitled Driving Financial Returns via ESG. This panel will be chaired by Andrew Farmer from KPMG, with contributions from our esteemed panellists, Lisa Calhoun from Valor Ventures, Degas Wright from Decatur Capital Management, Aoife Carney from Neuberger Berman, and George Latham from WHEB Asset Management. Market participants often look to studies on financial results on ESG versus non-ESG funds as the judgment of the efficacy of ESG investing, ignoring externalities that can materially influence study results. In this panel, we will look to the fundamental performance drivers from ESG. I am sure you'll find the insights to be fascinating, and do keep an eye out for further podcasts shortly from the Irish Funds Annual Conference.
Cognizant that we stand between you and lunch, so we will endeavor to do our best to keep it succinct, but I think it's a really interesting topic. We have a global perspective in terms of this panel, so very warm welcome to the panel. Thank you for coming. I might start with you, Lisa, and looking to the late night talk shows. We'll start at the end and come this way.
Sounds good, Andrew.
As you consider value drivers in venture capital, especially around ESG, what's often overlooked is the S element of it.
So true.
Can you speak to that as a champion of investing in minority and female-founded firms?
Absolutely. Hello, everybody. I'm Lisa Calhoun. I'm the managing founding partner at Valor Ventures, and I operate in the South U.S., which is the fastest growing geography in the United States. For context, like Ireland, we're a challenger geography. And so for us, averages don't really make a big difference. And so to Andrew's point, I guess it gets down to what you believe as an investor will create not just a little bit of outperformance in the future, but what will be enough to create leadership. And for Valor, that's people. We believe, especially in the age of AI, that AI augmentation of human beings is what is going to create suddenly a new competitive landscape. And so the S in ESG has never been more relevant, and creating a musculature around that that is articulated, written, and followed, updated, and innovated is really going to potentially reset some winners and losers in venture capital is within the fund landscape.
That's great. Very, very insightful. George, if we switch to the public equities side of this consideration, where are you seeing opportunities in terms of driving value through the lens of ESG?
Yeah, I think there's I'm George Latham. I'm the managing partner of Web Asset Management, which is a global equities boutique based in London. We have a mid-cap equities strategy, which is focused entirely on investing in companies where we judge that the product or service that they sell is a solution to a sustainability challenge. So we're quite focused and bespoke about where we invest in public equities, and it leads us to a kind of mid-cap oriented strategy. I think in terms of where value comes from ESG is a kind of, you know, is a generalized question which has got a very big range of answers, and it kind of depends. It kind of depends on what your investment philosophy, what your investment beliefs and what your investment process are, and what you're bringing into it from an ESG perspective, from all of the gamut of things that that represents. And so just to describe it a little bit in terms of what we do. So we focus first on finding companies where we believe the product or service has a positive impact on society or the environment. That leads us to a universe of about 500 companies that is naturally mid-cap, where the product is actively creating a cleaner environment, a better society, a healthier lifestyle, or so on. So we have 9 themes which have spread across environmental and social themes. We do that not just so we can say we have an impact or our investee companies have a positive impact or we have nice themes. We do that because we believe that these are companies which are enabling and therefore benefiting from the transition to zero, more sustainable economy. And therefore, their companies, this is a lens through which we can find companies that have strong growth over the longer term and will grow their profits sustainably over the longer term. When we've built that universe, the second part of our process is to find the higher quality businesses from within that. No, we want to find higher quality businesses, good companies that can sustain profitability from that growth theme over the long term. So when we think about ESG, which typically we look at how companies are run under that banner of how they're run from managing their own environmental risks, how they're run from how they address social issues, how they're governed, we do that not so that we can have a good ESG score. We do that so we can find good companies that are well run, that are going to be successful in the longer term. And so because we are growth-oriented investors, and we want to find growth companies, this is a lens that helps us find growth companies. Because we want to find good quality companies, and then we are long-term investors, we have an average holding period of 5-7 years or longer. You know, so naturally, if you're holding companies for a long time, you want to be good stewards of those investments. So stewardship and engagement, which is the kind of third angle of it, is how we own companies. Once we bought them, we own them in our portfolio. So we're very engaged. It's a very two-way conversation between ourselves and our investee companies. Not because we want to have a good engagement report or we want to be able to tick some boxes on that, but because we want to work with our investee companies for them to be the best they can be. There's no interest in us in owning a company for 7 years. If it's poorly governed, that just represents risk to us. So we want them to be well governed. We want them to be good decision makers. That's why we want a diversity of opinion around their board table or across their management structures. And so we come at that engagement and stewardship as a third lens, if you like. Because we're longer-term investors and because we want to work with our investee companies as investors as opposed to traders, as owners rather than renters, to generate strong returns over the long term.
Right, right. So we've looked at VC, the generally the mid-cap space, Degas in terms of large cap and in your view of international investing. What edge do you see in your application of ESG that's driving financial returns or value?
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. You know, one of the things, my name is Degas Stratton, I'm the founding principal of Decatur Capital Management, and we focus on global strategies, both U.S. and international. I'm also a signatory of the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investing since 2017, and also a member of the Global Policy Reporting Group for the PRI. And so to answer that question, you know, I looked at it from a vantage point of several years. The initial, we were looking at more the risk mitigation question. Mm-hmm. When we started looking at ESG, we saw that it was used for risk mitigation. And that's what I really call 1.0. That was back in 2015. As we come closer, we go to that 2.0 where we had companies that really focused on their corporate social responsibility reports. Across the globe, you had more and more companies doing those reports. So that's really the 2.0. 3.0 is really more identifying alpha opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so as we look at that, we then see the E. You know, how can we get alpha out of the E, the environment? One of the things that we look at is what's called carbon intensity. And that carbon intensity is measured by carbon emissions, which is the MT, which is the metric tons by carbon dioxide emissions, scaled over revenues. Mm-hmm. So we could actually measure that, and that's part of getting away from greenwashing. If we actually measure the carbon intensities of these companies, you could identify companies that are lowering their carbon emissions, that's starting that transition. And the example I always like to use is oil and gas. Mm-hmm. Because oil and gas companies had to start that transition process because they did not want to have wasting assets. So now you look at companies that have a transition plan. You can also start now applying it to a financial metric, return on invested capital. What we find in our research is that those companies that have transitioned have lower carbon emissions intensity actually have higher return on invested capital. Mm-hmm. So that's a way of applying the environmental piece to the returns because we focus on generating shareholders' value.
Sure.
You know, if you look at the S, how can you use S to make alpha? One of the things that we identified very early on in 2018, we were part of the UN COPALT group. Now, cobalt is used in batteries. And I see everyone using their devices now. That device is basically made up of cobalt in their battery. So that cobalt is actually mined in probably one of two places. The primary source for cobalt is Congo. And I think we all may be familiar with there's a lot of labor issues, child labor issues, in Congo. So in 2018, we started working with a company to engage with that company, see can they approve their human rights policy. And we've been successful with that company. And in 2020, that particular company changed their human rights policy to actually using their human rights policy to get to a point where they can lower their emissions. And the way they're doing that is that this company announced last month that by 2025, they're going to have 100% recycled cobalt in all their products. So if you don't have to have new cobalt, you lower the mining, the social aspect, but you also lower the carbon emissions.
It certainly drives value because the recycling, I'm sure, is helpful for their income statement and, you know, the financial outcomes of the company, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So shifting gears just a bit, Aoife, do you see the regulation in Ireland or the EU more broadly as creating opportunities for driving value or financial outcomes?
Yeah, so hello everyone. My name is Aoife Kearney. I'm an assistant general counsel in Neuberger Bergman's office in Dublin. And I work primarily on integrating ESG into our Irish domiciled funds. So to your question and to the wider topic of ESG driving financial returns, at Neuberger Bergman we look at the world in that we see ESG integration as part of our fiduciary duty. And indeed, that's how we protect and how we grow our client capital. So to us, it just makes sense that if you're going to invest in the company, you know, you're going to do your due diligence, you're going to discover all of the risks and opportunities attached to that company, including the ESG risks. I think this debate can sometimes be confused by terminology, and in the ESG world, the terms definitely do shift. So just to level set, when I'm talking about ESG integration from a Neuberger perspective, if we're looking at a company, an example would be if we wanted to invest in a supermarket chain, we might look at their labour conditions versus those of their peers, for example. If we wanted to invest in a company, like what's their board like? Is it diverse? Do they have the independence and the expertise that they need to really challenge proposals put to them and to deliver the best possible outcome for investors? So I see ESG integration as being slightly separate to outcome-orientated investing, which we also do, which I see as being more client-driven with a specific ESG objective. So that would be like, you know, your impact, your sustainable funds. And so now that we've level set, getting on to the recent flurry or the green tsunami of ESG regulation we've had, particularly from the EU, I think that this regulation has really put a spotlight on ESG, and that's helped to set minimum standards and also expectations among our investors, many of whom now see ESG integration as a minimum criteria for investing. And if we zone in on the E factor of ESG, almost half of our top 100 institutional clients at Neuberger Bergman have committed to some form of net zero target. And that's something that we're delighted to work with them to achieve. And it also sends out a really clear signal that ESG and particularly environmental objectives are at the core of their investment objectives going forward. We also have the EU taxonomy, and you know, I'm hugely conscious of the lack of available data, you know, right now for the EU taxonomy, but I do think when more data becomes available, especially when the CSRD is rolled out, that's going to help to identify best-in-class leaders, leading companies in terms of climate and in terms of companies that focus on the E. And then running through to the S, the EU social taxonomy seems to be really far away. But I would say that at Neuberger Bergman, we've seen a real increase in investor appetite to invest in sustainable funds with exposure to sustainable investments. And so when I say sustainable investments, I'm thinking of the SFRD, so the Sustainable Financial Disclosure Regulation. And as part of identifying a sustainable investment under the definition of 217 of that regulation, mm-hmm. you have to apply a list of mandatory indicators. And those indicators include environmental, social, and governance. And then like on the last, focusing in on the G, which is sometimes forgotten, but never should. If you don't have good governance, it's almost impossible to promote like the E or the S. So in conclusion, yes, I do think the recent regulation has put a spotlight on ESG. It's focused investor attention. It's made those products more attractive. We have better disclosures in place. And in terms of like downstream, where that could result is, that you'll start to see investors really finding companies that prioritise ESG engagement or ESG integration to be more and more attractive. That could help grow their market revenue, their market share, their revenue growth, and hopefully all of this will lead to increased investor returns.
And to your point at the very beginning, the terminology and the wealth of terms, yeah. Green tsunami was a new one for me.
Yes, I've heard this before. I like that.
Yeah. George?
Yeah, I was just going to pick up on some of the points that Aoife was making there. I like the distinction that you make between your kind of fiduciary duty and the kind of risk management aspects of ESG and then the focus on sustainability and outcomes. And that's where there's a bit of a bifurcation coming in some of the regulatory environments. We have the SSDR in Europe, which has really been on a kind of a sort of ratchet of Article 6, 8 to 9 in terms of the deeper integration. But in the UK, the approach is going to be really quite different. Mm-hmm. And there's a differentiation between ESG integration as risk management, as fiduciary management, which really is a fund manager doing their job. It's kind of good due diligence. It's what we expect to do. And it really, in many ways, shouldn't be called something different. It doesn't need labeling ESG. It's just good long-term due diligence. And when I describe the kind of process we go through of identifying companies that are having a positive impact to then finding high quality companies and being good stewards. The high quality companies and being good stewards part is just being fundamental, bottom-up, research-driven managers. Sure. And that is different to the focus on companies that are driving sustainable outcomes focusing on sustainability outcomes. So we do that through finding companies which are actively having a positive impact, so our investable universe overlaps with an index by about 15%. So there's an asset allocation element to investing in a fund like ours. Mm. Now it's definably different, and that as an approach to sustainability needs to be separated out from what will be and should really become the kind of table stakes really of ESG as a part of risk management, as a part of due diligence, as a part of good investment research. It's just thinking long term about things that matter and will affect companies over the long term.
Well, investors have a lot of options, for sure. Yeah. And one of the things that excites me about where we're taking the conversation collectively is that we have more options to find better solutions. For example, just really quickly, one of the companies in our portfolio does business globally. It's called Prolog Mobile. It's too small of a company for you to have heard of. But when you're talking to a large company that has a large fleet of mobile devices, like we all have one in here, and at least one, right? When those get recycled or reused, their components are very valuable. But right now, only Prolog Mobile has a database of how the value is for your organization. So if Man Group or KPMG wanted to upgrade its mobile devices, you could literally find millions of dollars of value if someone would aggregate that for you. That's mm-hmm. Prolog Mobile. That's one example of literally thousands of examples of entrepreneurs in this world who are solving global problems around environmental and social issues. And so what I love to hear is when equities investors like Decatur Capital Management or MidCap are looking for companies that not just are doing a good job of the day-to-day governance and a little bit of social responsibility, but also encouraging those companies to lean into the most innovative technologies available, because this world is moving fast.
Yeah, and what's really, I guess, exciting about the space that you're in is you have so much influence over those, you know, seed stage or mid capital cycle companies. So do you see ESG as a distraction or a value driver for those early stage
companies?
Andrew,
I'm going to come right across the panel on distractions. I think, let's look at it from a completely business value point of view. If you're a company today and you're starting off and you want to take on the world and your goal is to go IPO or maybe have a very large global acquisition, well, you have to do incredibly well, not just 10% better than the alternative, but likely hundreds of percents better. So how are you going to do that? Well, you're going to have great governance. You're going to have a social strategy, and this increasingly diverse and socially and ethnically fragmented society where the best in class talent speaks multiple languages and has multiple backgrounds and brings multiple perspectives to their conversation. If your company doesn't articulate your social strategy, you'll miss out on the best talent. You'll miss out on your window of competitive challenge. And then, of course, when it comes to the environment, we all care about our world. That is table stakes. But if you don't understand how the environment is affecting your supply chain, well, then you're not going to be very successful in that supply chain implementation. And that's just one example. And so I think ESG is fundamental to building challenging potential trillion-dollar market cap companies today. And that's how our investment team at Valor Ventures looks at our next investment as we lead seed rounds in potential contenders.
And moving up that capital curve, so looking at it from the VC perspective, that's very insightful. George, what do you see in the mid-cap space in terms of embracing that sustainable agenda, and what are the long-term benefits?
Long-term is a really important word, I think. And I think one of the reasons why a lot of investors really struggle with this agenda is that too many of them are just too short-term. You know, the average holding period in global equity markets just goes down and down and down. And if your average holding period is anything less than 3 years, then it's really this whole conversation becomes a bit irrelevant. And you know, because these are long-term trends, and you're talking about the impact a well-governed company is going to have, or a well-managed company is going to have. This is important if you're an investor. It's not really that important if you're a trader. And the problem is too much of the market is run by traders and not investors. And in that situation, it does become a distraction.
Sure. Yeah?
It's not so important. So it's also, I think, ESG ratings can become a distraction because you get, I don't know if any of the third-party ESG research companies are in the audience, but we don't use any of them. Because frankly, if you're trying to cover 28,000 companies globally and apply a same questionnaire which you're going to answer from scraping data off a few company websites, then you're not going to get to what's an important value driver for that company. Now, if you're a people-orientated business, then how you manage people is going to be really important. If you're a manufacturing business, then how you manage your environmental impact is going to be really important. There are going to be different issues at play in different companies. And so it's really important. That's why we don't have an ESG rating on a company. We have a quality rating on a company that we generate internally through finding the measures and the issues that are important for that company's success on a longer-term basis. And so I think that some of the way that ESG can be applied can be a distraction. And can be getting in the way unless it fits genuinely with your investment process and you're using it for the right reasons.
So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask Degas. I know you testified in front of U.S. Congress on the issue of ESG. From your perspective, what is going on in the U.S. and are the managers there missing the boat, or the public pension plans, et cetera, on the value that can be created in ESG?
Well, Andrew, I think I had the opportunity to testify in front of the U.S. Congress, and we talked about things such as political contribution risk, climate risk, the human rights risk, tax avoidance risk, and also the the requirement to have a sustainability committee reporting to the SEC. So, and that was back in 2019. And we haven't had that much regulation since that period. But to answer your question, I think as a manager, you have to take the material aspects that impact your company and take that into account. And that gets into the environmental impact. You want to have companies in your portfolio that are good stewards of their environment. You want to have in your portfolio, you want to have companies that have good leadership. And also, you have to have good corporate governance, going back to your point, because if they don't have that, you will be destroying shareholders' value. Mm-hmm. And so we look at it from a vantage point, and I think George made this point, that it's about investing on behalf of your clients, taking all the information, the mosaic, and bringing that into your investment decision.
Sure.
So I think asset managers, they get it. Other parties within the United States may not. And I think what we focus on as asset managers is that we focus on the objectives of our clients. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, you know, we will serve our clients well.
Yeah, and it's become so polarized in the U.S.
Yes.
I mean, it's fighting words, to use the term, right? So you can often roll up to a conversation and you're very sensitive to what the other person might think, because it's
right.
not commonly discussed in open conversation, mm-hmm. right?
Well, and a lot of that sensitivity is driven by the fact that the majority of the leadership of companies in the U.S. remains exclusively white male. Mm-hmm. And the belief that exclusively white male is not necessarily the intention has long been accepted as, they don't intend it, but these are great people and they're talented. And so we're okay with that. But there's an increasingly larger group of investment managers and investors and employees and people who want to work that are not okay with that.
Right.
And I think that makes nothing but sense. And so we're at a time of exciting opportunity around talent in the U.S. and leadership and who we want to be as a country.
Yeah, and as we move across the pond, Aoife, I know that you have a particular focus as an Irish domicile manager and looking at the fund structures here, the EU regulation. How has the Irish regulator specifically facilitated the implementation of the ESG agenda?
Yeah, I think that the Central Bank of Ireland, the Irish regulator, has been very pragmatic in its approach to implementing the SFDR and the EU taxonomy. And from like a practical kind of filing of fund documents perspective, the regulator introduced what I call a fast-track filing, but I think it's more formally known as like a streamlined process. And that was really helpful for UCITS or retail funds. And that gave managers a bit of space and a bit of time to get their houses in order, get their fund documents filed. Because with, for example, the SFDR, I'm not going to lie, it's been a challenge to implement. We had SFDR level 1, level 2. Now we have just filed our SFDR pre-contractual documents at year end, and they've been updated, and we have to file these again. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really essential that the regulator has such a kind of like a flexible attitude and recognizes those challenges. I would say that other EU regulators have not been as restrained in their approaches, and we've seen examples of greenwashing, which have really just been a huge headache for the asset management industry. So in one member state, there's gold plating of SFDR, which applies measurable criteria, minimum measurable criteria, and that just doesn't work across all ESG investment strategies. Mm-hmm. In another EU member state, there's gold plating of the MiFID sustainability preferences. It's really vague, it's difficult to implement. And I think that when you've got one national regulator gold plating a piece of EU regulation, it undermines the integrity and the competitiveness of the EU single market, and it undermines the ability of EU managers to passport and to market their products across the EU in a consistent way. And I think it also it disadvantages the managers who aren't domiciled in that region. So, you know, they're less likely to hear about the update until it's final. They're less likely to be involved in the consultation. They may not have the languages available in all of the EU official languages. So, you know, you're looking at a situation where you're translating documents and all of this is just hugely, like, unhelpful to a single market regime. So I think the CBI has been really pragmatic in its approach, and I'd like for other regulators to follow that approach.
Oh, absolutely. I'd agree with that. So I suspect that when everyone arrived here today, we crossed a group that was very passionate about advocating for, you know, defunding oil, et cetera. We sit as a group of practitioners at this intersection, right, where we likely share the sentiment. I don't want to speak for you. How do you think we transition away from oil? What do you think we engage the market with? How do we approach it?
Yeah, so, Andrew, what we look at is that we are engaging our oil companies, and what we're looking at, and I talked about the carbon intensity before, you want to identify those companies that are actively transitioning and reducing their carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And if you identify those companies in your analysis, you'll find that those companies are the ones that are the higher return on invested capital.
Sure.
So you want to identify companies, and let's talk about oil and gas, that are transitioning, because you do not want to continue to invest in those companies that are, well, may have wasting assets, because there will be a cost. And so what we've identified is companies that are part of the environmental partnership, which is 80 global companies, oil companies, that are focused on reducing their carbon impact. Mm-hmm. And so once again, it's not exclusion, but it's more engagement. I think, Lisa, you know, you made this point, is that we have to engage with those companies to have them make a difference.
I think engagement is great, and I like to engage a little differently. But using a venture capital strategy, we actively invest in climate tech. And so that helps create some of even the behavior changes mm-hmm. that are needed to reduce our global overall reliance on things that we should not be relying on anymore because of the way it affects our health and the way it affects our planet. So one quick example, because they're a great young firm, Ryder is a cycling carbon offset management platform for companies. And they have clients like the City of Christchurch, New Zealand, the Atlanta Regional Commission, and Ford Motor Company. But using technology and software, there are ways to not just directly attack the oil industry, but also change the behavior of we who use oil so that we no longer rely on it as much, and companies can gain the benefit of legitimate carbon offsets from behavior change in culture. And so we're really excited about climate tech as a sector in our investment thesis, and I think it has a lot of promise on multiple levels.
I totally agree with what Lisa's saying. I mean, we only invest in solutions. We only look for companies that are actively enabling the transition to happen, and therefore they benefit from it. It's very simple in a way. You know, companies that are part of the solution, and they will benefit from those solutions being adopted. And I'm delighted that Extinction Rebellion are sitting outside this room. I think it's brilliant that they're here. And I would really genuinely encourage any of you to engage with them. Go and talk to them, listen to them, hear what they've got to say, because what they're saying is really important. And I think, you know, a lot of us would agree with a lot of what they say. Mm-hmm. And I think that the problem with what happens in these rooms is that the scale of the challenge and the urgency with which we need to deal with it is just not appreciated. There's too much kind of tummy tickling going on in terms of, you know, we can put in place the odd spreadsheet and say that we've done a bit here, or we've applied these ratings over here, but are we really engaging with the dramatic nature of the challenge and the speed with which we need to
I think
move?
Too many investors are satisfied with incremental progress, when actually, as investors, we can have transformational change. Yeah. We just have to own it.
Yeah, and I think there's a real risk that investors will get left behind. Mm-hmm. Because the economy itself is moving faster than the investment industry.
For and sure.
And that's more happening out there in the real economy than is appreciated or where the finance industry is itself. And I think there's a real risk that a lot of the investment industry will just get left behind as the transition happens.
Thank you. Thank you for your insights. I think it's really interesting to look at the various pockets that each of you serve and get that perspective. For anybody that's keeping track of the new words today, I've got gold plating, green tsunami, and tummy tickling. So those might turn into hashtags, I suspect, coming out of this.
One.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Very, very big thank you for joining today and sharing your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.